The World is supported by LegalZoom for those wanting to start a business or secure their family's future. From wills and trusts to LLCs and trademarks, LegalZoom is committed to helping people get started. LegalZoom.com/world.
At the mall, Saudi style, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Saudi Arabia has long been trying to change its work culture, and that means convincing Saudis to do the kind of jobs once reserved for foreigners.
10 years ago, you had the labor minister of Saudi Arabia being photographed flipping burgers.
We'll hear how that's going. Also, NBA player Enes Kanter has left the Knicks, but he won't leave the U.S. for fear the Turkish government will come after him.
Almost everywhere I go, I always have someone with me. Only place I go alone is the restroom.
Plus, turning America's trade deficit with China into sound. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thanks for being with us this Wednesday. Has the Trump administration improperly tried to share sensitive nuclear power technology to Saudi Arabia? That's the question members of the House Oversight Committee are asking this week. We'll turn our focus to that in just a few minutes. First, though, we're taking a close look at Saudi Arabia this week and how things are changing there. The kingdom is one of the world's biggest oil producers, and oil money has, for a long time, funded lots of cushy government jobs for Saudis, mostly men. But one of the big changes happening in Saudi Arabia is the notion of who does which jobs. Here's The World's Shirin Jafari.
The Riyadh Park shopping mall looks like any upscale mall in the States. There's Gucci, Dior, Sephora, Starbucks. The only difference is the shoppers. Men are wearing long white robes. Women are in black ones. Some women have covered their hair and faces. Inside this glitzy, overly perfumed mall is where you see the shifting work culture in Saudi Arabia in action.
Can we try this woman?
Yeah. Okay.
The woman I'm referring to is a cashier at a gourmet popcorn store. And that voice saying yes is my government minder.
Hi, do you speak English?
No.
Hessa is 25 and has been working at the popcorn store for 2 months. She loves it. From under her black face cover that only shows her eyes, Hessa tells me she lives with her parents, like so many young Saudis do, until they get married. Her family, she says, provides her with the basics, like a roof over her head and food. But for everything else, like clothes and eating out, those she has to pay for herself. And this job gives her a chance to do that. Okay, maybe she also loves popcorn.
Oreo popcorn. You love them.
Only a few years ago, the sales clerks and baristas at these stores would have all been men. Foreign men, not Saudis. And definitely not Saudi women. In the 1930s, geologist Fred Davis was working for the Standard Oil Company of California in Bahrain, the Persian Gulf country.
And for townspeople and Bedouin alike, life was an endless struggle.
Davis suspected there might be oil in nearby Saudi Arabia.
He wasn't the first to think there might be oil in Saudi Arabia.
Ellen R. Wald is the author of Saudi Inc., a book about the history of Saudi Arabia's oil industry.
The British actually thought there might be and did a little survey work and concluded that, nope, Saudi Arabia didn't have any oil.
Facepalm of the century.
And then, at Dammam, it happened. Oil in commercial quantities had been brought in.
It completely transformed not just the Saudi economy, but also Saudi society.
The government began selling that oil, and money started to pour in.
The government was making a lot of money from oil, and they were using that both to develop their country, but they were also employing a lot of people.
Cushy government jobs became plentiful, Walt says, and once you were in, you were pretty much set for life. By 2016, two-thirds of employed Saudis worked in the public sector, according to the Saudi Ministry of Labor. Karen Young with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., says Saudis came to expect government jobs, as well as cheap, subsidized fuel, water, and electricity. For the jobs they didn't want to do, like cleaning, construction work, and sales jobs, they brought in foreign workers.
And so by asking foreigners to come in and do lower wage menial work, Saudis haven't had to do that kind of work.
And that's true in a lot of affluent countries like the US. But here's the thing with basing your entire economy on oil. There's only so much of it, and market prices go up and down. The Saudi population has also been growing, so it costs more to provide the same level of assistance.
So the government took the step to say, okay, we're going to reduce subsidies, especially on electricity and water and fuel.
Karen Young again.
And we're also going to implement a value-added tax, so a 5% tax on everything you buy. And so this has been, you know, a real shift in the way that, you know, we think about the relationship between citizen and the state, what's expected and what you get in return.
And Jane Kinnenmon, who has studied the Saudi economy and politics for the past 15 years, says the government didn't stop there. It started a campaign to tell Saudis, hey, menial jobs are, well, jobs.
10 years ago, you had the labor minister of Saudi Arabia being photographed flipping burgers because they wanted to send the message that menial jobs actually could be a source of pride.
Older Saudis grumbled, but younger Saudis, especially women, embraced some of these jobs.
This lady, she's crazy.
Until 7 years ago, when the laws changed, women had to get permission from a male relative to work in a retail job. Back at the mall with my government minder, we stop at a Victoria's Secret store. No scantily clad mannequins in the windows, they're in modest pajamas. Before, even lingerie shops had all male staff, mostly foreign workers. Now the staff are all Saudi women. Jihan is getting ready for his shift. She's an English major at the university, and in the evenings, she works at this store. She's been on the job for a year now. Jihan says even though she didn't need her father's permission to work here, he was resistant. 2 weeks after she started her job, he showed up at the store.
He came surprised for me. What you want, what you do, what's happened to you. Is man here? No. Is man comfortable? Yes.
There he was, Jihan's father at Victoria's Secret, checking out the store, making sure his daughter worked in a respectable environment where she's not interacting with men.
How did you feel about that? Like, were you nervous?
I don't know. Fal, Bab, what did you do? What happened to you? I didn't do anything wrong.
Jihan says she was shocked, but explained to him that everything was fine, that all her colleagues are women, even her boss.
And he said it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
Jihan doesn't plan to stay in this job for long. She wants to start her own company. She says she's seen more and more Saudi women entrepreneurs, and they inspire her. These jobs, selling lingerie and popcorn, they might not seem like a big deal. But to the Saudi government, they're part of a plan to transform the economy. Because at the end of the day, jobs keep people occupied, says author Ellen Wald.
You don't want a lot of unemployed people sitting around because that breeds discontent and it will breed political instability.
And one thing's for sure, the Crown Prince doesn't want that. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Riyadh.
Tomorrow, we'll hear about efforts to boost tourism to Saudi Arabia and why the kingdom is eager to attract more visitors from around the globe. Now to that nuclear story we mentioned earlier about concerns over the potential sale of nuclear power technology with the Saudis. A new report from the House Oversight Committee says that senior officials in the Trump campaign and Trump administration pushed for that sale and that their efforts may have violated the government's own legal and ethical advice. And the deal isn't dead yet. President Trump met with executives from a business consortium just last week. Sharon Squassoni worked on nuclear issues for the State Department and the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. She's now a research professor at George Washington University.
What's really interesting is that for legal reasons, back in very early 2017, the National Security Council decided that it would be a bad idea to push the consortium's plan to sell nuclear reactors to Saudi Arabia. And somehow this is a plan that is not dying. And that's what this report says, that there was this meeting just last week or so where this consortium again met with President Trump. I have to say, I think the release of this interim report is designed to keep Jared Kushner from making promises he can't keep when he goes to the Middle East next week, because clearly their investigation is not complete. So I think that explains the timing. But the report itself, which is full of a lot of really interesting details, doesn't prove that Westinghouse was, you know, ready to sell reactors legally to Saudi Arabia. I don't think that was in the cards.
And Westinghouse is a nuclear reactor manufacturer. Do we know why the National Security Council determined that it was unwise to sell Saudi Arabia nuclear reactor technology?
I'm not sure that the NSC legal office decided that it was unwise to sell reactors to Saudi Arabia. It's just that the way it was proceeding was not according to, processes and procedures that have been in place for decades. So it's not that it would be illegal to sell nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia. It's just this particular plan, what they're calling the Middle East Marshall Plan, and the cast of characters that were involved in it was a little unsavory.
Why shouldn't the U.S. sell nuclear energy technology to Saudi Arabia? What's wrong with that?
At this point in time, there have been several official statements from Saudi Arabia that are particularly concerning. It's not just the Khashoggi murder. It is the fact that Saudi Arabia sees Iran as a big threat in the region, and they have point blank said, if Iran gets nuclear weapons, so will we. So the fact that we could consider even engaging in peaceful nuclear technology exchange with a country that seems prepared to violate its treaty obligations not to get nuclear weapons, I think, is a bridge too far at this point.
The Nuclear Energy Consortium, the group that's pushing these deals, IP3, they are denying any wrongdoing. And their supporters say it's in America's interest to secure these contracts rather than to see them go to Russian or Chinese competitors. How do you respond to that?
This is an argument that the nuclear energy industry, the U.S. nuclear energy industry, perennially makes. Wouldn't you rather that these countries have U.S. technology rather than foreign technology? It's hard to respond to that. In a way, I'd like to say yes, but the fact of the matter is that once countries have technologies, it's very hard to control. We've had situations with Taiwan and South Korea, both of which had clandestine nuclear weapons programs in the past. They had U.S. technology, and yet it was really hard for us to rein them in. So I don't think that IP3 had nefarious plans. I think when they signed these letters and they were approaching the Trump administration, they didn't intend to get caught up in all this back channeling and lying to Congress and attempts to personally profit off of this. And so I think they're correct in saying that, you know, they didn't intend to have this terrible outcome. But, you know, often bad things happen with the best of intentions.
Sharon Squassone has worked on nuclear issues for the State Department and the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. She's currently a research professor at George Washington University. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
What does our trade deficit with China sound like? That's just ahead, here in the world. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Trade negotiations between China and the United States are continuing this week in Washington. And apparently, there's been some progress, because now President Trump claims that March 1st isn't some magical date. The president had previously threatened to raise new tariffs on Chinese goods on the first day of March unless he got what he wanted from the Chinese. Trump has long insisted that the U.S. must reduce its trade deficit in general, but especially with China. So how's he doing on that? Here's The World's Jason Margolis.
If you think of our trade deficit with China in sound, each beat is a month of trade data. The steady high notes represent a continuous and small trade deficit in goods with China. In the 1980s and 90s, they're selling us a bit more than we're selling them. Our trade deficit with China was a few billion dollars a year back then. Chump change. Then China joins the World Trade Organization in 2001 and basically gets a seat at the big kids' table, which means it can trade more with the rest of the world. So the deficit goes from this to this. Lower notes means a larger trade deficit. China starts selling us more and more stuff. We sell them more stuff too, but not nearly as much. Ships are coming to the United States overflowing with toys, computers, bikes, you name it. Those ships are returning to China like 80% empty. Our trade deficit grows to about $350 billion a year. Then Donald Trump bursts onto the scene.
They're draining us. They're taking our money. They're rebuilding themselves.
You look at what China has done to us for so many years.
They're ripping us up, folks. It's time. We have to have fair and we have trade deficits. They have surpluses.
We've been ripped off by China.
They're taking so much money.
The theft of American jobs and wealth has come to an end.
But has it? The U.S. trade deficit with China reached record heights last year, around $400 billion. So if reducing the trade deficit with China is one of President Trump's top priorities, and the exact opposite is happening, what's going on?
Well, I think Trump talks a good game. But overall, Trump's economic and trade policies are actually making our trade problems worse.
Robert Scott is a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute, a think tank in Washington that's partly funded by labor unions.
He put in place this massive set of tax cuts, mostly for the wealthy. That's very traditional Republican economics. So he talked like a populist, but he acted like a traditional Republican. I think it's that conflict which is at the root of the failure of his trade policies.
Trump's tax cuts have forced us to borrow more, which drives up the cost of the dollar. A stronger dollar means imports from China get cheaper and our exports become more expensive, which makes it harder for U.S. manufacturers to compete with foreign factories and therefore harder for the U.S. to narrow the trade deficit. But wait a sec. Trump has a plan. Tariffs against steel, washing machines, solar panels, and thousands of goods coming from China to drive manufacturing back to the U.S. If only economics were that simple. Economist Katie Russ at the University of California, Davis, says the tariffs are creating global economic uncertainty.
And so when there's uncertainty and people start worrying about global growth, the dollar is a safe haven.
More demand for dollars pushes up the dollar's value even more, which again makes U.S. exports less attractive. Here's how the dollar has measured against the Chinese renminbi since March. You want the pitch to be getting lower if your goal is to boost exports to China, but that's not what's happening. But what could the president do to reverse this? Joseph Gagnon is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Oh, there's a lot he could do to move the dollar down if he wanted to. I've been a little puzzled as to why he and his team have ignored that.
Again, decreasing the dollar's value would make U.S. exports more attractive.
If he wanted to do more, he could intervene in foreign exchange markets. Lots of other countries do.
Basically, the Federal Reserve could step in to weaken the dollar. Trump could also tax foreign investment to discourage overseas investors from driving up the value of the dollar. There's other tools in that toolbox handy for lowering the trade deficit.
Which is basically the opposite of what he's been doing.
So that's one part of the story. Here's the other part. What does this matter? Why is President Trump so focused on bilateral trade deficits? Again, economist Katie Russ.
From an economist's point of view, there's no reason to think that a bilateral trade deficit is necessarily a problem.
Global trade is like going to the mall, where each country is a store. Colombia's got good coffee, Japan has cool TVs, so we buy those things. The U.S. has a store at the mall, too. Right now, we buy more stuff than we sell. To Trump, China, Europe, Mexico, Canada, they're all ripping us off. Economists see it differently.
It basically means that you are consuming more goods than you're producing.
That's it. And for a wealthy country like the U.S., a trade deficit can actually be a sign of strength. We have the money to buy a lot of foreign goods. Now, there are certainly trade problems to address with China, like forcing American companies to share their technology in order to locate factories there. China has also built up its industries, like steel, with state subsidies, which can distort global markets and make it impossible for other countries to compete. But looking or listening to a bilateral trade deficit as a one-note scoreboard, a simple way to see who's winning and who's losing? Well, international economics, it's a lot more complicated than that. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Want to hear more of what our trade deficit with China sounds like? We've got full sonification at theworld.org. South Africa has one of the biggest economies in Africa, but it's facing a major power crisis. Electric power is the problem. South Africa's state-owned utility, Eskom, has a near monopoly over the power industry, but it's been a financial disaster. Not just for the company itself, but for the national economy. Mismanagement and corruption are widely seen as the root cause, but how to straighten out the company is a matter of public debate. Today, South Africa's finance minister announced his plan for a bailout of the utility.
We are setting aside 23 billion rand a year to financially support Eskom during its reconfiguration.
Some tepid reaction there, but also some applause for Finance Minister Tito Mboweni. 23 billion South African rand, by the way, is about 5 billion U.S. dollars. That'll be paid over 3 years to Eskom. But Mboweni wanted to point out that the deal is not a blank check.
The fiscal support, this is very important, the fiscal support is conditional on the appointment of an independent chief reorganization officer who will be jointly appointed by the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Public Enterprises.
The head of Eskom wanted more bailout money from the South African government, and Mboweni declined. He said pouring money directly into the state's utility in its current form would be like pouring water into a sieve. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up on The World, women in Turkey face stigma and backlash when they seek divorce.
My father told me that he would disown me because I was doing something that God does not agree with.
And yet Turkey's divorce rate keeps rising. That story's just ahead, after the news. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Big news for fans of the Portland Trailblazers today. Enes Kanter, the 6'11 center, formerly with the New York Knicks, is joining the West Coast team. This news is not likely to be in the headlines in Kanter's home country of Turkey. He's been an outspoken critic of the Turkish government, and he even fears what could happen if he goes back there. At times, Kanter has responded to the controversy with humor. Here he is on Trevor Noah.
If you talk against the government or the regime or the President Erdogan, then they think they're your terrorists.
Right.
That's why they were claiming me as a terrorist. So I'm like,
yeah, they've labeled you as a terrorist.
Yes, and then I actually tweet that and say, only thing I terrorize is their basketball rim. You know, that's how you gotta put it. You know what I mean?
It's not just a joke, though. We caught up with Enes Kanter today just before practice, and I asked him where his fears come from.
They came to my house 2 years ago, and they took all the electronics away. They raided my house in Turkey, the phones away, laptops away, computers away, and they wanted to see if I'm still in contact with my family or not.
Are you taking security precautions now as an NBA player in the U.S.?
Of course. I mean, almost everywhere I go, I always have someone with me. Well, the only place I go alone is the restroom.
I've read that you believe that the Turkish government's after you because of your support of Fethullah Gulen.
Yes.
And at what point in your career, in your life, did you start feeling pressure from the Turkish government?
Well, I think it all started with the coup attempt back in 2016, July 15. And after that, I was very outspoken about all this politics stuff and what's going on in Turkey. I have a very big platform. That's why they were trying to get after me.
You just said the only place you go to alone is the bathroom.
Yes.
What are the sort of daily security precautions you take?
Well, I always have someone with me, even if I go to a street, if I go to a restaurant, if I go out there to walk, practice, arena, basketball gym, just in case I always have someone with me.
Has your family ever been able to see you play basketball?
It's very crazy because I was playing with New York Knicks and they banned every New York Knicks games in Turkey. Before New York Knicks, I was playing for Oklahoma City Thunder and they banned every Oklahoma City Thunder game in Turkey. So it's so hard for them to even watch me play basketball.
When's the last time you saw your family?
Last time I saw my family was back in 2015.
And do you have any plans to visit them?
Of course, I want to see my family. I actually wanted to bring my family in America but they made a hole in their passport so they cannot travel.
And is your family also supporters of Fethullah Gulen?
They were. Back in the day, yes.
Do you feel like your celebrity and fame gives you a kind of protection?
I think so, because I don't. If they do anything to me or my family or anyone I know, it becomes viral in America and in Turkey.
What about Turkish friends of yours who don't have that security? Do you have Turkish friends who are also overseas and don't have that same security?
Yeah, of course. I mean, my story is just one. And there are lots of stories out there is way worse than mine.
Do you have any message for your fans back home?
I wish I can tell them and show them that I am not a bad guy. I'm a good guy. All I'm trying to do is try to stand with democracy, freedom, and human rights. You know, I understand this is not my job. I'm not a journalist. I'm not a politician. I'm just a basketball player. But just because of no one is out there going to talk about these issues, I have to talk about these issues. And of course, it does affect my career. It does affect my life. But it's the road I'm taking because I'm trying to be the voice of all those innocent people.
You've got this political drama that's part of your life. How does it feel when you just get out in the court and play basketball?
It's tough because you always think about the issues, or always think about your family, or always think about those innocent people, or always think about all those innocent people in jail. If I bring those conversations to the court, it'll be very selfish of me. Whenever I step on that court, it's just me, basketball, and my teammates.
NBA star Enes Kanter, he's recently been traded to the Portland Trailblazers. Thanks, Enes. Have a great practice.
Thank you guys so much. I appreciate it.
Rising divorce rates. That's nothing new. It is new in Turkey, though. Women and men there are getting out of unhappy marriages, but the Turkish government wants to keep couples together, for better or for worse. Fariba Nawa has our story.
I meet Nebia in Istanbul. It's far from the home and the life she used to have.
Yani burada bir şeye geldiğim zaman geliyorum. Özel olarak kafelerine gelmiyorum.
Nebia asked me not to use her last name. She grew up in a religious family in Konya, one of the most conservative cities in Turkey. When she was 18, she moved to Istanbul for college and began working at a literary magazine. That's where she met her husband.
Entelektüel olarak bilgi sahibiydi.
He was kind, intelligent, and not authoritarian like the other guys.
They got married with their family's consent, and he took a job as a professor in a small town. At the age of 22, Nebia became a stay-at-home wife. But there were hints of problems from the beginning, she says. Her husband could be jealous and emotionally abusive.
Sen galiba politik işlerle uğraşmak seni şey cinsel isteği azaltıyor. Çünkü sen hiç istemiyorsun dedi.
But she says the main reason she wanted out of the marriage was their sex life. Nebia says before they got married, both of them were clueless about sex.
İşte seküler olanlar kendileri tecrübe eder bir şey kazanıyorlar.
In secular families, they can talk about sex and experience it before marriage. But in conservative families, they don't even talk about it with their mothers. Also, sex is usually thought of for men's pleasure. Women are just supposed to procreate.
When Nebia asked her husband for a divorce 2 years into the marriage, he agreed eventually. The hard part was telling her family. Even now, she seems uncomfortable talking about it.
Ve işte babam bana, sen Allah'ın razı olmadığı bir iş yapıyorsun.
My father told me that he would disown me because I was doing something that God does not agree with.
Even though divorce is becoming more common here, many people think it's still shameful. Turkey's conservative government promotes a family values agenda, and President Erdogan has said all women should get married and have at least 3 children.
Kadının iş hayatındaki konumu, onun anneliğini...
Yet during the 17 years Erdogan has been in power, the marriage rate has fallen and divorce has gone up. The government estimates anywhere from 22 to 40%. It's mostly women calling it quits. That's according to İpek Buzkurt, a women's rights activist.
Alo? Yo, o niye bankaya gidecekmiş ki?
They're so fed up with their marriages and the treatment they receive, the treatment their kids receive. all the physical and psychological pressure that they have suffered, they're just willing to go and let that marriage go, whatever the results are. So they're really fed up.
Buzkurt is also a divorce lawyer. And she says one reason Turkish women are leaving their husbands is that more women are earning a living.
So when a woman earns her own money, looks after the kid, does the housework, she sees that at some stage she doesn't need the husband at all.
For those who earn less than their husbands, they're entitled to alimony. Even though divorce rates are still relatively low in Turkey, the government is worried. And it's investing in counseling programs to keep couples together. On this pro-government TV program, former minister Fatma Betul Sayan Kaya encourages couples to get counseling. Kaya, who's divorced herself, says we don't want couples to divorce over problems they can solve. She adds that the government counselors don't tell couples what to do. But women's advocates say the counselors sometimes send wives back to abusive husbands. In surveys, domestic violence is the number one reason women give for seeking a divorce. İpek, the lawyer, says the government is in denial about this. Another concern is the government's stance on alimony. The justice minister has publicly defended men who complain about paying alimony. And advocates worry that means the government will cut back support for divorced women in need.
Bence yanlış karar aldım. İş yeri açmak oldu. Yani bir yere...
Nebiye, the woman who divorced her professor husband, moved back to Istanbul, where friends helped her until she found a job. She's 30 now and getting a master's. And she works on labor rights. She's also stopped wearing a headscarf. For her devout Muslim parents, that was it. They've cut off contact with her. She says it hurts to lose her family in exchange for her freedom.
Of course I miss my family, but I don't think it's right for them to have disowned me in the name of God.
Nebiye says she feels lonely at times, but happy and relieved too. For The World, Fariba Noah, Istanbul.
Fariba's story was a collaboration with the New York Times Review of Books. Finally, a cause for a little bit of optimism over the war in Yemen. It's been devastating for civilians there for more than 4 years now. But the warring sides have begun to agree on some things. Diplomacy in the Yemen crisis was fast-tracked by the United Nations last fall.
It was a major shift, and it showed to the people of Yemen that something was indeed happening.
That's the UN's top diplomat on the Yemen crisis, Martin Griffiths, speaking this week in New York. The UN and world leaders have been trying to figure out how to get fighters in Yemen to become talkers. They sometimes turn to policy advisors for help, such as the Belgium-based International Crisis Group. The ICG's Peter Salisbury says the war in Yemen is complicated, but there's a way to understand it.
The very simple version of the story is that we have a conflict between the Houthis, this rebel movement from the north of Yemen on the one side, who control most of Yemen's northwestern highlands, receiving support from Iran. And then on the other side, we have the government of Yemen, which was displaced from Sana'a, the capital, by the Houthis in 2015, which is backed by a coalition led by Saudi Arabia.
What progress have you seen in the UN-led effort to bring peace to Yemen?
Well, where we've seen progress, we can't really say it's progress that necessarily will lead to a peace process. During the last 6 months of 2018, the really major issue in the conflict was a potential battle for Hodeida, this port and city on Yemen's western coast, its Red Sea coast. Hodeida provides about 70% of all goods shipped into Yemen, and Yemen depends on imports for basic things like wheat and rice. So a battle for the city would have been really catastrophic, and the UN said would push the country into a really big famine. So over the final 6 months of the year, the major diplomatic push was just finding a solution to prevent a battle for port and city. In December, we had this meeting in Stockholm, which produced this thing called the Stockholm Agreement, which basically calls for a ceasefire and for the demilitarization of Hodeida.
Now, you mentioned Hodeida. It's a key city, a main port, and there are silos of grain there waiting to be distributed. Has any progress been made in getting that grain and flour to the people who need it?
There are multiple grain storage sites in and around Hodeida. The most important is one called Red Sea Mills, which is on the outer edge of the city. And the World Food Program was using it as its main storage and distribution facility. It's also a mill, so it's where wheat is turned into flour. WFP haven't been able to access it since last September, and a big part of the conversation has been around how WFP, the UN, can get back in there. And what we saw this weekend was an agreement for a first phase of military redeployments around Hodeidah in order to provide access to Red Sea Mills.
Yemen has been called the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. In addition to food shortages, what else is making life so difficult for Yemenis?
First, civil wars aren't great for economies. So for a lot of people, the only job they can get is fighting on the front lines. There's a huge problem with fuel shortages, electricity shortages, which makes it hard for people to get from place to place, to do work, to get to the hospital. There's a shortage of medicine. So all the things that we take more or less for granted as basics in our day-to-day life just aren't there right now.
Peter, you've been working on Yemeni issues for years. Why do you care about what happens there?
So I've worked on Yemen for about 10 years now. Most people who've lived and worked in Yemen will tell you that it's just a really magical place. And the really sad thing is that most images that people see of the country are of war, destruction, and this really deep trauma the country is going through. But it's also this warm, wonderful place, unlike no other. And having watched its descent, having gone through the excitement of the Arab Spring, but then watched things get worse and worse after the Arab Spring, I think that my main point of interest is just seeing the country turn some kind of corner. So my friends, the people I know, and the majority of Yemenis can live just sort of decent, ordinary lives, and the country can go back to being some semblance of what it was a decade ago.
Peter Salisbury is with the International Crisis Group. Thanks a lot, Peter.
Thank you.
The Mexican town of Tlaxiaco is pretty remote. It's in the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca. But it's been getting a lot of attention lately in the American press because it's the hometown of actress Yalitza Aparicio. She's up for a Best Actress Oscar this weekend for her role in Roma. But the town also has a close connection to the U.S. through a radio program that brings families in the U.S. and Mexico closer together. Emily Green is in Tlaxiaco. Emily, what's it like there?
It is a small city. It's about a 7-hour drive from Mexico City, and it's high up in the mountains, quite arid. I'm sitting in the center plaza right now, the town plaza, and I'm looking out over a market. And this region has really been one, you can hear the town bell right now saying that it is 12 p.m. It's quite beautiful, actually. It's this beautiful clock in the center of the plaza. And also, this town is known for a radio show called La Hora Mixteca. And you can hear it here in Tlaxiaco, but you can also hear it in Fresno.
And you're talking about Fresno, California?
Fresno, California. There is a large community of people who originated from this area of Tlaxiaco and the surrounding areas. And the radio show is meant to forge ties between the community here and the migrant community that lives in the United States.
How does the radio program work? How does it bring families together?
What you essentially have are hosts in both Tlaxiaco and in Fresno, California, and they're talking back and forth. And what you'll often hear on this radio program is people in Fresno or people in the area surrounding Fresno sending saludos, sending greetings to their family back here in Tlaxiaco. And it's quite incredible. For example, in the most recent airing of the show on Sunday, this woman came in and she wanted to send a message. The woman is talking Triqui, which is another indigenous language here in the area. And what she's telling listeners is that her son, he's 27, moved to the U.S. 10 years ago, and they were in touch until last March. And she hasn't heard from him since. And so what she's asking listeners to do is say, hey, if you have any news of my son, if you've seen him, if you know where he is, if you know if something happened to him, please contact me. And at the end of the clip, she even gives her telephone number. And the astonishing thing is that this kind of strategy, it's worked. Now, it doesn't always end up with happy news. The host of the show here in Tlaquiaco has an uncle who migrated to the U.S. in 2010, and he went missing en route. The host went on the show, said, does anybody have any news about him? And nobody did, and he's been missing ever since. And the interesting thing is that any person I ask on the street has a story of migration. They have their uncle has gone, their father has gone, their mother has gone, or perhaps they've gone and come back. It is really a town with intense ties to the U.S.
Why Fresno? What brought people from Tlaquiaco up to Fresno in the first place?
I think that it initially had to do with agriculture, and it sends back decades to the Bracero program when the U.S. was basically hiring Mexican workers to come work in the fields during the picking season, and then they stayed, and then over the decades, more and more people from this region have gone to Fresno because of the agriculture.
Is this migration flow from Tlaquiaco to Fresno still happening?
It is happening. But I would say with a caveat, when I was wandering around the center yesterday here in Tlaquiaco, I saw a couple of kids rapping. They were in a sort of a rap-off. So then I talked to one of the rappers, and it was interesting. I said to him, do you envision yourself going to the U.S.? And he said, I envision myself traveling, but not going to the U.S., not going to El Norte, he said, because they won't let me in. And so we might see some of these migration flows changing. And in fact, big picture, far more Mexicans are returning to Mexico from the United States than they are immigrating to the U.S.
Emily, are the citizens of Tlaquiaco rooting for Yalitza Aparicio?
Yes, but I'm sort of surprised by the lack of posters or signs I see about the movie Roma here. And I think lots of people have seen it, but this is also a town where there's no movie theater and where it's still pretty isolated, so even getting a signal can be difficult. Yes, they're rooting, but I'm surprised to some degree by the lack of Yalitza propaganda.
We'll see how people feel after the Oscars on Sunday. Reporter Emily Green speaking to us from Tlaquiaco, hometown of Oscar nominee and star of Roma, Yalitza Aparicio. If you want to see what her city in Oaxaca looks like, check out our photo essay at theworld.org. We end today's program with music from one of the biggest musicians to come out of Tlaquiaco, Lila Downs. The Mexican singer-songwriter is known for celebrating the region's traditional music, but she's also just as open to celebrate and collaborate with other artists from throughout Latin America. Her most recent collaboration is with French-Chilean rapper Ana Tijoux.
Perdí toda vergüenza, dejé toda cordura. Y a mis amigos por sorbos de locura. Creía que era dulce, hoy solo es amargura.
Together they sing Tijoux's ballad Tinta Roja.
Olvidé mi nombre, mi apellido y mi casa. Se fue lo que tenía y a todo quien amaba. Cambié toda mi vida por copas y garrafas. Ahora te preguntas si vida si aún te queda. Cuarta de aventuras y harás ya una alma plena. Jugada en sus culpas, se hunde en sus mareas. No queda más camino que hallar en tus recuerdos. Algunas luces vagas que alumbran tu encuentro. Quizás solo encuentres botellas por el suelo. Somos fantasmas, sombras que se han perdido en su oscuridad.
Mexico's Lila Downs and Chile's Ana Tijoux singing Tinta Roja. And one more thing before we sign off. You've been hearing reports from Antarctica by the world's Carolyn Beeler over the past few weeks. She's on a research ship working alongside climate scientists. They're studying one specific glacier that could really affect the rise of global sea levels. And while scientists are trying to answer questions about climate change, Carolyn is answering your questions about the research they're doing. What do you want to know about how global warming is changing the iciest continent and how scientists work in such an extreme environment? Send us your questions about climate research in Antarctica, and our reporter will answer them as the expedition continues. The email address is myworld@theworld.org. That's myworld@theworld.org. And that's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.